Welcome to another edition of the Baseball America Prospect Handbook Podcast. J.J. Cooper and Ben Badler with you today as we welcome you to a new year. Happy New Year to everyone. We hope you had a wonderful holidays. And we're excited to not only be in 2016, but we're excited because we are done with the Prospect Handbook, which is, if you work at Baseball America, it's a pretty huge moment because it's an all-encompassing, I'd say, three-month project in many ways. But the Prospect Handbook is on its way to the printers. If you go to baseballamerica.com/store, you can order your Prospect Handbook from us right now. You will get it first. You will get it well ahead of if you order it from anywhere else. We get it first, and then we ship it out as quickly as we get it. We turn it around and send it out. And if you order from baseballamerica.com, you also will get an additional prospect for every team. We do a supplement, the 31st prospect for every team. So instead of 900 prospects, you get 930. And actually, you get a little bit more than that because Ben wrote up a number of international prospects who had not signed as of the deadline for the handbook. One of those, I want to talk about right away because around and send it out. And if you order from baseballamerica.com, you also will get an additional prospect for every team. We do a supplement, the 31st prospect for every team. So instead of 900 prospects, you get 930. And actually, you get a little bit more than that because Ben wrote up a number of international prospects who had not signed as of the deadline for the handbook. One of those, I want to talk about right away because Kenta Maeda just signed with the Dodgers. We don't know the full parameters of the deal. We do know that it appears to be an 8-year deal. It appears to have a very modest base salary, but then it has a relatively significant incentive structure. So, Ben, it just jumps out to me. I guess I'll ask you, since you are our international expert, what can Dodgers fans expect from Maeda, and did the structure of this contract surprise you at all?
I think you can expect him to come in and be an immediate big league starter, somewhere in the the middle to the back of the rotation. I think most scouts that I've talked to and from seeing him pitch several times over the last three seasons now, I think the general consensus was this guy can come in and be a really solid number four starter right away. It's, the fastball is about, generally 89, 93. He'll touch a four or maybe a five, but he's not going to overpower you with velocity. He's going to rely mostly on command and mixing his stuff up, trying to hit the corners and keep you off balance. Mostly a fastball slider pitcher, pitching in Japan. And the slider is not, it's not really like a wipeout slider where you call it a true plus pitch. It may flash that at times, but it's more of a 50 to 55 type offering on the 28 scale. It's definitely going to be an effective major league pitch. It's just not going to be a knockout pitch where you feel comfortable putting him at the top of the rotation and racking up a ton of strikeouts. He is prone to hanging that pitch sometime. I think it's going to get less swing and miss against major league hitters than he was able to get against Japanese hitters who just aren't quite as good. But what was really interesting about him was the changeup, which was never really a big part of his arsenal during his time pitching in MPB, but when he was pitching in the Premier 12 in November, that pitch was better than his slider, which was really surprising. I mean, it was really lively, really good sink and fade and separation from his fastball in the past. It really wasn't a big pitch for him, so I don't know how much you can really hang your hat on off of a couple of outings in November compared to the whole track record that he's built in Japan in his previous history. But certainly I know he was toying around with the grip a little bit with a changeup. So all right, now if you have a guy who's got, two average to solid average pitches in the fastball and the slider, then he's got the changeup working in. If that can be another, solid average to potentially above average pitch for him, all right, well, maybe now instead of a number four starter, he could be a number three. So it's definitely an interesting guy. Not very big. There's got to be some durability questions for him, for anybody going from, they have an extra day of rest in Japan that he's mm-hmm. not going to, well, I should have presumed, I guess I'm presuming that he's going to go to a more traditional major league schedule on a five-man rotation, although maybe the Dodgers will have some more flexibility with that to try to, you know, give him some more rest, give him some extra days in between his starts, which I think would be beneficial when you're trying to transition a guy who's been really conditioned his whole career to pitch one way. So I do think he has a chance to be a solid number three starter. I feel more comfortable projecting as a number four, but I think there's more upside there for him to be a number three.
Yeah, and it is, you touched on it. I don't expect them to do anything really unconventional, but the reality is that the Dodgers have the rotation depth, at least as we sit here in January, that if they wanted to be a little creative here, they have those options. They have, it's interesting, they've taken an approach that really, I think their offseason, they've obviously lost one of the best pitchers, starting pitchers in baseball, but their approach has very much been that they're going to look at depth as being a very key factor in them competing in the West in 2016. You look at all the moves they've done. Maeda does not replace Zach Greinke. I mean, obviously. However, you look at their rotation and they can sustain an injury or two in their starting rotation and still survive. You look at the players that they acquired in that kind of odd three-team White Sox, Dodgers, Reds deal. You look at Trace Thompson and Micah Johnson and Frankie Montas. I don't expect any of those guys to be significant impact players for them in 2016, but it also wouldn't shock me if a couple of those guys ended up being very useful pieces, role players for them. They have a lot of guys like that. That's not even counting guys that they bring back from that they already had. And they have Corey Seager, they have Julio Urias, they have Jose De Leon, a number of guys who are not that far away who could help them. You know, Seager could help them right away. Urias and De Leon could help them at some point in 2016. This feels to me like maybe the deepest team, which considering their payroll is not shocking, but it seems like, do you get the same sense that this is kind of depth over impact is kind of how they're approaching this?
I think this was not their plan A. I think plan A was to sign Zach Greinke and it didn't work out. And so now they'll get the rotation and no team is going to go through the season with five starting pitchers. Need to have depth. Somebody's going to get hurt. And when you look at that rotation, their starters in particular, somebody is definitely going to get hurt. It's a lot of injury risks in that rotation beyond Clayton Kershaw. I mean, right now, you know, there's not a lot of guys you pencil into that rotation and count on for durability.
No.
But they do, like you said, they do have a lot of options at the major league level and close to the major league level with guys like Jose De Leon and Julio Urias. And who knows, maybe, you know, Zach Lee, I'm sure, might get some spot starts as well as a back-end type starter. But it is a lot of, number three, four, at best three, more number four type starters beyond Kershaw and beyond Kazmir.
Right. It's Kershaw, Kazmir, and then you are talking the Alex Wood, Brandon McCarthy's, Mike Bolsinger's, and, Maeda, and, again, it's 8-9 deep. It's just 8-9 deep on guys. Obviously, the guy who could kind of change that is if Julio Urias has an impact rookie year, second half of the season, he could be in that playoff rotation. That's asking a lot of a guy who is still younger than many of the 2016 college draftees will be, but he does obviously have that kind of stuff. It's a fascinating team to watch. I do agree with you. It's kind of on a plan B, but it is fascinating to see how they've moved on to plan B and kind of where this team goes from here. That leads me into another team I want to talk about since we last had a podcast. Sorry, we had a little bit of delay there because of the holidays, but also because we had to get out the prospect handbook, which is, as we said, all encompassing, but the Reds have traded Aroldis Chapman to the Yankees and brought back really the key pieces being Rookie Davis and Eric Jagielo, and then you also have Caleb Cotham and Tony Renda, which obviously There's no other way to put it. A rather, if you're a Reds fan, that's a rather disappointing haul for one of the best closers in baseball. Obviously, that's been very much affected by the fact that Aroldis Chapman is being investigated for an alleged domestic violence incident that happened in mid to late 2015. But with that, Ben, did the paucity of the haul that the Reds got back surprise you at all, or was that kind of expected to you because of the cloud that kind of is hanging over Chapman?
Yeah, definitely. After the domestic violence allegations came out against Chapman, that really shot his trade value. I mean, certainly the Reds are selling low on Chapman's value. You wonder if maybe they could have held on to him and see what happens with the suspension and try to, you know, hope some of his value bounces back. Because I don't think there's any question about his talent level. It's more about the situation that he's involved in and all the, all the stuff surrounding him off the field that is keeping teams away from him and keeping his value down. So, I wasn't surprised that it was that light, but yeah, like you said, certainly an uninspiring return, given the talent level that Chapman has.
And obviously there are parts of this that we just do not know, but we don't know if the Reds kind of from ownership on down would kind of give them the mandate, no, you're going to trade Chapman now. But if there wasn't that, I kind of do look at this and say that this is trading Aroldis Chapman at absolutely positively the worst possible time, because the unknown of a potential suspension and the unknown of a potential of the ongoing MLB investigation craters his trade value. Where if you said that Aroldis Chapman remained a Red and we were talking about this come next June, July, I do think trade value wise, it could be significantly higher. It is obviously possible. We do not know. We have no clue right now, even if Chapman's going to be suspended, and if he is, how long that will be. It is worth noting, and this is not making any apologies for, there's an extensive story at Yahoo that kind of details an attempt at an explanation of what the police found when they were called out to Chapman's residence. But there were no charges filed. It is possible Chapman's not going to be suspended. On the other end of the spectrum, if Chapman's suspended for, I believe it's more than 40 games, which would be a extremely lengthy suspension. But if that happened, then Chapman will not become a free agent after the 2016 season, but it would actually be after 2017. From that standpoint, on a purely baseball terms, this is an amazingly good deal for the Yankees. Obviously, from a PR standpoint, it is a poor deal for the Yankees in the interim. They're going to take some a significant hit because people are upset that they've traded and acquired a player who's accused of domestic violence, and you're not going to find anyone who's on the pro-domestic violence side, obviously. But it is something where this bullpen, assuming Chapman is pitching, this bullpen, if they don't make any trades, Betances, Miller, Chapman, that allows them to get extremely creative, especially if the Yankees do make it to October. Those three guys in the pen, and that's, again, not assuming you always have a few other guys beyond that, but three truly closer, elite closer caliber relievers in the same pen, that's a great way to get around having a lack of significant ace starting pitching, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a different guy, and Chapman in particular, who I think you could look to use in multiple inning roles too. You don't have to, when you have three guys who are that elite at what they do out of the bullpen, I don't think it's been a matter of whether you call one of them your closer or one of them your so-called eighth or seventh inning guy. I don't think that role is going to matter.
No.
I think you just use whoever, depending on whatever the situation calls for. Whether it might be the sixth inning of the game, and you might see Aroldis Chapman in the game if it's you know, the bases loaded and a tie game, and then the other team's best hitter is up, and it's a lefty. Well, now I guess you have two lefty options between Miller and Chapman. So I think you have to ignore kind of traditional roles because you just have three guys who are premium elite, back of the bullpen, you know, clearly traditionally considered closer type guys. And you can, you know, I think Chapman in particular, I mean, I still think Chapman could be a starter. I'm not advocating putting him into that role. But I think if things have gone differently for him,
yes,
in his career, this is a guy who has the, you know, the delivery and the arm action, and the athleticism, and the durability to hold up as a starter. I think he could stretch him out and use him in multiple inning roles, especially if you're only going to have him for 1 year and you're not really concerned about, managing his workload over the course of several years. You want to get the value out of him right now. I think you could see him being used and lengthened out in some more creative ways if the Yankees want to go that route.
Oh, I think in the playoffs, I would not, with three guys like that, I wouldn't have a problem if I was the Yankees and you've got a shakier starter out there in the playoffs, third, fourth inning. Yeah, fourth inning, if you're facing, you know, the top of the lineup's coming up again because the guy's given up a few hits, a few runs, I would be happy to say, you know what, every time we go through the middle of the lineup, the fourth, the sixth, and then we'll let, you know, one of those guys kind of pitch the eighth, ninth. There's so many off days during the playoffs. I think almost any of those guys can be considered occasionally a two-inning guy. Then you really can kind of pick where you say fourth, fifth inning on, the middle of their lineup, their best hitters are not going to face anyone who's not one of our three-headed monster. I think it's a kind of a fascinating story to see kind of what, you know, how this kind of shakes out. We're going to take a quick break from the podcast again just to remind you that it is a perfect time to go to baseballamerica.com/store and order your 2016 Baseball America books. The Baseball America Almanac, the complete summary of everything in baseball in 2015. And when we say everything, we mean the majors, the minors, college, high school, the draft, international. You want to know who stood out in Japan in the Japanese leagues in 2015? We've got it in the Baseball America Almanac. You can get the Baseball America Almanac. The Prospect Handbook will be out soon, and we have the Baseball America Directory and Super Register coming before too long as well. So go to baseballamerica.com/store to order all your Baseball America books. Well, Ben, we talked about Chapman, but let's look a little bigger picture at the Reds rebuilding project as it's going on. Clearly, they're rebuilding. They have finally, they kind of pulled the trigger at the trade deadline this year and said, okay, it's time to rebuild. They traded away most significantly Johnny Cueto and got a pretty significant haul back from the Royals for Johnny Cueto. But overall, do you feel like this is a team that is pretty far along in their rebuilding process, or is this a team that's still got a significant while to go before they can really try to contend again in the very, very tough National League Central?
I think they're in an odd place right now, that they're sort of stuck in the middle, which is, you know, I think their farm system is, it's not great, it's not bad, it's just kind of in the middle of the pack right now. But there's talent on the major league team still there, but I look at the rest of the NL Central, and the Brewers have sort of, they're committing to a full-on rebuild, whereas the Reds, I'm not quite sure what the plan is for them right now. I mean, that division is just so daunting right now, where you have the Cubs that have the best young team-controlled lineup for several years, and now they have the pitching too, obviously, with Arrieta. And Lester are the top of the rotation. The Cardinals are there every year, winning, you know, 95, 100 or so games. They're one of the best franchises in baseball. And the Pirates are our organization of the year, have, you know, an extremely talented team and a good farm system. I just look at that division it's challenging enough for a team like the Brewers that really looks like they've committed to a full rebuild now. I think their window for contention is still a few years away. But with the Reds, it's just, there's so many teams ahead of them that are so well run and have young talent that it's going to be sustainable for those teams going forward. I have a hard time seeing what the Reds' window for contention is right now.
And the rough thing is that as far as the rebuilding, they've traded at this point most all of the tradable pieces they have, and it's not been an overwhelming haul back. I mean, Johnny Cueto, they got a significant return for. Cody Reed, I think, is pretty easily a top 100 prospect going into next year. And John Lamb, Brandon Finnegan, it could be a top 100 prospect, depending on who if it wasn't for the lack of eligibility anymore, because he has pitched, I believe, enough now. It's been a long time. Sorry, the prospect handbook has overwhelmed me, so I'm trying to remember I think he has enough games now that he does not qualify. But you look at that, Jose Peraza as a solid prospect. He's another top 100 guy. But beyond that, it's a lot of guys who Scott Schebler is more of a role type player. And you look at the farm system, there's a lot of pitching prospects, a lot of interesting pitching prospects. On the position player side, though, there's some nice guys who I think are potentially solid regulars, but there aren't as many guys you say, that's going to be a potential cornerstone guy. Probably the guy who jumps out is Tyler Stevenson, their first round pick last year, who's a long ways away as a high school catcher, just drafted last year. I think they're a pretty good ways away. And part of that is the key pieces for them is going to be they're picking number two in the draft this summer. And that's going to be in June. That'll be very important for them. And you look at this team, you look at that division, you say they probably will be drafting pretty high again in 2017. Well, those pieces are going to be, you pick two, you pick in the top five, you can land guys who end up being very useful and impact players sometimes before too long. That's what they need to do. They have to have some more of that, because as we've seen, Brandon Phillips probably still going to be there because he's got a no trade. And I know another way to put it, but if you're not going to accept a trade to the Nationals to play for your former manager, Dusty Baker, there probably aren't a whole lot of teams that are going to meet your requirements to waive that no trade. Joey Votto has many, 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 he's a great player, but he has many years left on his deal and is pretty much there for the duration of not only everyone who's currently on there are Reds prospects who haven't been drafted yet who will be no longer Reds probably by the time that Votto contract is over. And beyond that, I mean, Jay Bruce does not have the trade value that really, it's kind of shocking how his career's gone for the last couple of years. It's really gone in the wrong direction. They've traded Frazier. You look at it now, you say they've traded Chapman. There aren't a whole lot of other tradable pieces that, Devin Mesoraco has to prove that he's healthy from a pretty significant hip injury last year before he'd be tradable. And you kind of want to have some guys to build around. As you put it, it's a very difficult division to see. You compare that group to the Cubs or the Cardinals or the Pirates. It's going to be a pretty long slog. And it's going to be a long slog for the Brewers too. But the Brewers, as you said, they kind of had the advantage of they have less talent at the big league level right now. That means they're going to, it's not an advantage, but it does mean that they're going to be drafting high probably for a couple more years. The Reds do seem like they have enough. Joey Votto, and if Homer Bailey's healthy and Mesoraco and all, may make them a 75-80 win team for the next couple of years. And that's going to maybe keep you there for a little while. Again, it's a tough position to see where the Reds are now. And you do have to think if they could have just pulled the trigger on rebuilding even 4 or 5 months before they did. If they'd have done it going into last year, they would have maybe, landed some kind of significantly more value than they are by trading a Todd Frazier or obviously an unforeseeable situation, but an Aroldis Chapman now. So we'll see how that goes. We do want to also talk before we wrap up here today. We've wrapped up the prospect handbook. We've put together 900 scouting reports. We've ranked the top 30s for all 30 organizations. As we said, if you go to baseballamerica.com store and order it from us, we've actually ranked the 31 prospects in every organization. Ben, as we kind of proofed it, looked over it, wrapped it up, I'll ask you, I guess I'll start with, is there an organization that stood out to you in a good way or a bad way as you read them to say, hey, this organization really impresses me with their talent, or this organization really did not impress me with their talent?
You know, I think one of the organizations that jumped out to me was the Rockies. It's been a while since the Rockies were a competitive team, and I think they're going to need a lot more than just the farm system, but the talent they have right now is pretty impressive to me. They're definitely one of the top 10 farm systems in baseball, and they probably just don't get quite as much national media coverage just because of the market that they're in. But I think there's a lot of talent in that system. I'm really high on Ryan McMahon. They have a lot of other guys in that system that are pretty interesting guys who have pretty good combination of upside in depth in that system. It's probably one of that. I mean, we always talk about, you know, the talent in the Dodgers and the Astros and obviously what the Braves have done with their trades and the Red Sox, even though they have emptied out a little bit of the tank with the trade for Craig Kimbrel, giving Manuel Margot and Javier Guerra to the Padres in that deal. But I think one that doesn't get talked about all that much is the Rockies, and I think they stack up pretty favorably with some of the best systems in baseball.
No, I think the Rockies have one of the – it's interesting. There's different ways you can value organizations. I think the Dodgers are one that jumps out with as far as impact talent because – you look at, they have two top 10 guys in Seager and Urias, and then De Leon's not that far away from that. You look at the Rockies, what the Rockies stand out is that you get to number 8, number 9, number 10 on that Rockies top 10, and it's still guys who you really like, who are very impressive prospects, not guys. I mean, there's a lot of organizations where you get to 5, 6, 7, and you've kind of hit the natural – the difference between number 6 on the list and number 15 isn't as much as the difference between 1 and 5. With the Rockies, that point where you hit that demarcation line of kind of the type of prospect that everyone has, well, almost everyone, I wouldn't say the, you know, start looking at you, Los Angeles Angels, but that almost everyone has, happens a lot later. And they are impressive from that standpoint. I also, when I was kind of looking at it, The middle, the teams who I don't even think of as top 5, top 10 organizations, but I do feel like that this is a year because there's a lack of impact prospects. A lot of impact prospects have jumped up and are now in the big leagues. But there are a number of organizations who, when we roll out our organization talent rankings, are going to rank right in the middle. I would say that I still think have some intriguing systems because they have depth. This is a depth year more than an impact year just because I do think it's a down year overall for prospects in the minors because we saw so many players promoted in the last 2 years. It's not going to be a great top 100. We should hype it and say, this is going to be the greatest top 100 you'll ever read when we roll out the top 100 prospects. No, it's not. This is not a great top 100. But that being said, I feel like the demarcation line between the teams that just are downright bad farm systems, there's a few of those, and then there's a whole lot of systems in the middle. I have to ask you, Ben, I'll put you on the spot, one that you've done, you know, we're rolling out this week, we'll be rolling out the Tigers top 10. That's one to me, that's kind of on that line of the systems that are really pretty thin. Is that how you feel, or now having done it, do you feel like there's a little bit more there than that?
Yeah, they're definitely one of the, bottom 5 or 6 systems in baseball right now, I'd say. And part of it is, look, the David Price trade that they made, they got Daniel Norris and they got Matt Boyd, and those guys are not technically prospects anymore.
But they are young.
They're young, controllable talent. So that helps. But they also did trade for Michael Fulmer, putting him, as a guy who's in double A and probably can make an impact, for the rotation by the All-Star break. That certainly helps their system. Having a guy like Michael Gerber break out, adding Bo Burrows and Christian Stewart at the top, with their top draft pick. I think there's more talent there than there was a year ago, even without including Daniel Norris and Matt Boyd in that mix of guys anymore, or Devin Travis, who obviously they traded away the same day we named him their number one prospect last year. So I do think there's more talent in there than there was a year ago. But I mean, you look at where the major league team finished last year and where the talent is in the farm system right now, I think you're going to be looking at a pretty similar outcome in 2016 that we saw in 2015 for them. But I see a few other organizations that are clearly below them. Obviously, like you mentioned, the Angels. I mean, that one just jumped out. Obviously them and the Marlins and the Mariners are three organizations in particular that, there's not much talent in the pipeline there.
No. We'll have we'll do an org talent ranking podcast at some point and kind of go into it in depth, for all the different teams. But I guess I'll throw out one more to wrap up along those lines also. Was there a prospect or two that really stood out to you from a yay or nay status that as we went through this process, you go, huh, I either like that guy a lot more than I thought I did when it started, or I don't like him as much? Anyone jump out to you?
I guess, what's interesting is because we all do, me, you, John, and John Manuel and Matt Eddy have our top 50 prospects in the handbook. So obviously we talk a lot and we have a lot of the same information on these players, but we all view these players, through different lenses. So I like having those different top 50s in the book. And there's always some guys that jump out and say, oh wow, I didn't realize I was, that much higher or that much lower on a certain guy compared to, some of you other guys and where you have them ranked. So I think one guy that probably have higher than most is Brett Phillips, the center fielder that the Brewers acquired at midseason from the Astros. I think it's a guy who just has a chance to be an impact player who can bring a lot to the game on through a lot of different dimensions to his game. I think he's a guy who can hit, and I realize the power dropped off after he left Lancaster, but I don't project him to be a big 20 plus home run guy. I still think there's 10 to 15 home run type power there, but I think it's a good swing. I think he's gonna put the ball in play. He's gonna get on base at a pretty solid clip for you with just enough pop for a center fielder. Runs well, plays really good defense in center field at a pretty neat position with a strong arm too to help his defensive value. I think there's a lot of dimensions to his game that I really like. So he was one guy who I realized I ran pretty high up my list compared to other people.
No, I think you were the high man on Phillips, and I like him a lot. You just summed up, which is the question is he's not hit for power anywhere but Lancaster. Is that something that's going to be a long-term trend, or is that something where he's a young player and it's developing and he has shown it, although he showed it in Lancaster? So it's going to be interesting to watch. The good news, as you summed up, is that this guy's a true center fielder. So even if the power doesn't show up, he can be a very useful big leaguer. If the power shows up, then that takes him the difference between being a solid big leaguer and being potentially a pretty significant impact player. That's one of the things I'll wrap up with is that one of the things that jumps out to me is just how much talent the Astros had in that farm system. Because if you look at, you can put together a pretty good top 10 of prospects that the Astros have traded, in the last year and a half. And they still have a very good farm system even without those guys. Obviously, we are not even talking about there's the Mark Appel, Thomas Eshelman trade that they sent, with the Phillies to get Ken Giles. That trade, Vince Velasquez involved in that as well. Obviously, it was a pretty significant piece. They could do that trade, and they still have significant pitching depth in the system. They traded Brett Phillips at the, in midseason for Carlos Gomez, and they seem to be fine in the outfield. And Jacob Nottingham was a very interesting catching prospect, kind of who really came on this year. They traded him, and they're okay at catcher. That's a very, very deep farm system, even after making a significant number of trades to try to win in 2015 and in 2016. And I just look at them, and that's an organization that really does do a good job of producing mass quantities of prospects. There is, as Napoleon likes to say, you know, quantity has a quality all of its own. There is something to quantity of solid prospects. The Astros have a whole lot of solid prospects who are pretty valuable in trades. And then at the same time, they've done a good job of picking up additional pieces. Oh, can you throw Francis Martez into that deal? How about David Paulino in this deal? Those are the kind of trades where they pick.
Their most recent deal where they it seemed like they reworked the trade and said, all right, well, you know, you can have Mark Appel, but you have to give us Jonathan Araúz back from the Phillies.
And with their track record now, you go, okay, so that guy's probably going to, you know, really emerge. He's already a solid prospect. You had him in your GCL top 20, if I remember right. But he's the kind of guy who, okay, now I expect him to have a really breakthrough 2016, where this time next year we're going, wow, well, look at what an astute pickup that was. You have to be worried a little bit when teams are saying in a deal, hey, can you throw in this GCL guy? They're not just, those aren't throw-ins. They think they know something. And they've done pretty well with that, obviously, in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great strategy. It's something I've kind of talked about for years, because you look at the GMs are not attached to these guys really until they get the full season ball. I mean, GMs are, I mean, you want to say they're making the decisions in the best interests of the franchise into perpetuity, but they also realize they have a shelf life as well on their own contracts. And frankly, some guy who, especially an international player who, especially was not a really high bonus guy and was not a high draft pick. There's no first round draft pick label attached to him, although apparently that's getting less and less meaningful, as we saw, this offseason with Dansby Swanson getting traded. But there's just less attachment for the GMs to those players. So you can trade a guy like Francis Martez, who you signed for, I think it was like $70,000-$75,000 or something in that territory. And the Marlins knew, he was really good, but frankly, if it comes down to doing a deal and you just have to throw in a Francis Martez, obviously a Francis Martez pre-blowing up in 2015 and getting a double A as a 19-year-old, a GM is gonna do that deal, so you can get a lot of upside and a lot of talent, if you're just willing to take on a guy who's farther away from the big leagues. And yeah, like you said, the Astros have done a great job of snagging guys like that, whether it's David Paulino or Francis Martez or now Jonathan Araúz. And yeah, like you said, that they've lost a lot of prospects, and even obviously Carlos Correa, who they didn't lose, but they graduated to the big leagues. But there's still a good combination of not just depth, where I think a lot of teams say, oh yeah, we have a lot of depth, but you know, they have a lot of guys that are fairly fungible. Every system has, you know, those guys that those types of guys in the system. The Astros have, you know, a lot of upside too, and a lot of potential impact guys at the top of their system. Obviously, even with Correa graduating the big league, guys like AJ Reed, Bregman, from this draft, Kyle Tucker and Dan Cameron and Marquez,
Joe Musgrove. Joe Musgrove, yeah, to me, is a guy who reached double A. Has impeccable control. I mean, check out his strikeout to walk numbers if you're listening to this. And goes with that, this isn't a guy, they traded away Thomas Eshelman. Thomas Eshelman has impeccable command and control. Thomas Eshelman is your typical command control guy who does it with fringe average to, if you really love him, average stuff. Joe Musgrove, who's had a pretty lengthy injury history, we have to say, you know, that's the trepidation, but Joe Musgrove has impeccable control and command. And he does it with absolutely legit stuff, a big guy who looks every bit of what you expect a starter to look like. He does that with, you know, 94, 95 mile an hour fastball on his best nights. So it's something where that's not their best pitching prospect, and he might not be their second best pitching prospect. You could argue maybe he's their third or fourth best pitching prospect. That's the kind of depth that this system has.
Yeah, and it's always interesting to see where teams go who've been consistently picking at the top of the draft and really build their farm system that way, to see, all right, well, what happens next? And we saw it with the Tampa Bay Rays, or we're going to see it now with the Royals and the Pirates. And so what's going to happen now with the Astros? Because obviously they've used their top picks and their top bonus pools, the way they've leveraged it in a very smart and creative way to snag a bunch of top talent in the draft, even if in later picks, whether it's a guy like Dax Cameron or just picking, you know, top draft picks like Kyle Tucker and Alex Bregman. But the Astros seem to me like an organization that, like you said, has built a lot of depth and not just through these top level guys, the top of the draft type guys. They really have a knack for finding, especially more college polished bats who seem to maybe slip through the cracks, slip under the radar, but perform well in college and seem to continue to perform well moving up the ladder. Whether it's a guy like Tyler White, who I'm very high on Tyler White. I think he could be maybe a Kevin Millar type of player if everything goes well for him. I think they've shown that they can get these guys in the later rounds of the draft too, where, all right, even though they're not gonna have a top five pick every year, I think I'm still optimistic. They're still gonna be able to keep that pipeline going, even when they're not picking in the top five anymore.
It is. It's a fascinating farm system still, and that's with a team that now is a playoff team and should be better in 2016 in many ways than they were in 2015. For one thing, they'll have a full season of Carlos Correa. So, Ben, we'll wrap this up for now so we can get back to doing some writing and some reporting. But thanks for joining us. Thanks for all you for the download here at Baseball America, Baseball America Prospect Handbook Podcast. We would, you know, if you do enjoy the podcast, we'd ask you, hey, you know, subscribe on iTunes, but also write a review for us. We'd appreciate that. Even if you don't like it, you know, we'd appreciate if you write the positive reviews. But if you don't like us, feel free to write a review too. You know, we take criticism and we like the kudos. But we do want to remind you again, go to baseballamerica.com/store and you can right now. It's a great time not only to get the books, but also you can subscribe, baseballamerica.com/subscribe. And you can subscribe right now and get the next few issues are very power packed. We are working on right now the AL Central Top 10 Prospects issue is one that's hitting the website and will the actual magazine, the actual digital edition as well, will be up very shortly. And then you have the American League West Top 10 Prospects will be the next issue. Then the extremely and always power packed college preview will be coming up, which not only is great if you're a college baseball fan like all of us here at Baseball America, but also great if you are a draft fan, because it also has a massive amount of draft content and a look at kind of who you should be watching. And the great thing is we've been at Baseball America long enough to remember when it was hard to watch college baseball on TV, and that's no longer the case now. And you can enjoy kind of prepping for the draft by watching a whole lot of college baseball in the spring. And all that's coming up at Baseball America. A lot of great stuff coming up. Again, we thank you for the download. We'll be back again later this week with a college podcast as Teddy Cahill, Michael Anana get ready to head to the ABCA Coaches Convention in Nashville, the biggest gathering of college coaches that you'll see all year. That's coming up later in the week here at Baseball America. And as always, go to baseballamerica.com. A lot of new content every day. Thanks for the download. For Ben Badler, I'm JJ Cooper. So long, everybody.